You haven't heard the talk yet. How do you know that? Anyway, thank you very much for the invitation and for the nice introduction. And thank you all for coming. I'm going to tell you today about some work we've been involved in for a number of years, but the story I'm going to end up telling you today is rather new. So I hope you like it. Anyway, the title is actually a question, and I realize after hearing from Will that my abstract, at least to one faculty member, none of the words were familiar. So that's okay. I'm going to define all the words here. We'll go along, and it will all make sense. But the idea is that there are certain receptors on a certain cell that allow it to swim up gradients of chemicals toward things it wants to eat. And it turns out that in this very well-studied system, these receptors are clustered. And they're clustered for a reason. But it also turns out that if you look at other cells and look at their receptors, they aren't clustered. And so the question is, if it's good for one cell, why isn't it good for another? And that's what we're going to try to address. So in doing this work, I've had a number of wonderful colleagues on the theory side. And in this particular work, I'm indebted to Monica Scogie, who was a graduate student at Princeton, is now a postdoc at UCSD. We've also been incredibly indebted to our experimental colleagues, in particular Viktor Surjic and his group at Heidelberg. And as theorists, we really wouldn't have anything to do if it wasn't for the experimentalists like Viktor and Will here, who are actually learning what these cells are doing and thinking, using all of the modern tools of biophysics and molecular biology. We also have been very happy to have been supported in this work. So let me begin with an outline so you know where we're going. I'm going to give you a necessarily somewhat brief introduction to a field that has absorbed hundreds or thousands of scientist years, that is chemotaxis in this model organism E. coli. But I'm going to introduce it from the point of view of the engineering challenge. Without worrying about the details of the biology, you know, what would it take to design a cell to do something that these cells do, which is to find food? And I hope that having gone through this engineering challenge and thought about it together, it will motivate us to look at how the cell actually resolves this problem, what techniques it uses to solve the engineering challenge. So we'll look at the actual network used by the cell, and in particular, focus on the receptors that are sensing chemicals in the environment. Our interest in this work was stimulated by the beautiful experimental results from Viktor Surjic using fluorescence resonance energy transfer to look at what the individual cells were actually thinking. So you can look inside the cells in real time as they're changing their chemical environment and see how they respond to that change. And what that technique reveals is that the receptors cooperate. They're not just clustered, but they're actually working together functionally. And indeed, that cooperativity adapts. Sort of the degree of which they cooperate depends on the conditions that the cells are in. This will then motivate the question of, well, if this is so great, you know, cooperativity is working for these cells, why in other organisms, when we look at the receptors, they don't appear to cluster and they don't appear to cooperate? So why this dichotomy? And that will lead us to think about, well, is there some cost to cooperativity? Is cooperativity, you know, all good, and then these other cells are just making a mistake, or are there costs? And what we'll find is that the real cost of cooperativity is that it increases the noise. And under some circumstances, this will prove to be a real killer for the use of cooperativity. That said, I'd like to close by saying, well, indeed, in the case of chemotaxis in E. coli, the receptors do cooperate. So why in this case is this noise not a problem? And finally, I will conclude. So I first want to show you a movie of E. coli swimming around. This is thanks to Howard Berg, who, in addition to being the dean of chemotaxis studies, was one of the mentors of Will Ryu, who's here in the physics department. And one is looking at individual bacterial cells swimming around. And so each of these cells is about 2 microns long, maybe 1 micron in diameter. And the reason it's able to swim around is that each of these cells has 5 or 6 rotary motors. And each motor is turning a long protein filament called a flagellum. And when all of the motors go in the same direction, when they all go counterclockwise, these flagella, which already have a chirality, a handedness, they bundle together. And you can see an example, it's not very clear on the screen right now, of a bundle, which looks a little bit like a long propeller of a ship. When this propeller or this bundle turns, the cell is propelled forward. So that's how the cells swim. But when one or more of these motors changes direction, that actually makes the whole bundle come apart. And the cell then randomly reorients its direction. The motors then all start going back in the counterclockwise direction. The bundle reforms, and the cells swim again. So this is constitutes alternating runs, where the cell is swimming, and tumbles, where the cell changes direction. So this is called the run and tumble of E. coli. Now, just running and tumbling would lead these cells to be able to diffuse around, but it wouldn't let them actually follow chemical gradients. And so the way they do that is that the cells tumble, randomly choose some direction, and then start swimming in that direction. And what they do is they ask, are things getting better? If things are getting better in terms of their chemical environment, they decide that we're probably going in the right direction, let's keep swimming. If things are not getting better or getting worse, they say, well, maybe there's a better direction to go in. They instigate one of these tumbles, start off in some new direction, and swim. And as a result, when the cells are swimming in the right direction, they tend to swim longer. And when they're swimming in the wrong direction, they tend to swim shorter. So they end up performing a biased random walk. And this biased random walk turns out to be an efficient way of eventually moving up some gradient of some chemical, perhaps some sugar, that the cells like to eat, finding the source, getting there, and eating it all and making more cells. So let me show you this again. The reason you can see these particular cells is because they've been stained with a fluorescent dye. And we'll come back to the importance of using fluorescent tools in modern biology in a moment. And so you can actually now see in fluorescence these flagella, and you can see the cells running and tumbling. Now, it's worth remarking that already I've said some things that are not so obvious how the cell does it. Well, we've got the motors, and they've got to turn those. Okay, the cell has energy sources to do that. It's got to change the directions, but it also has to sense how things are in the environment to know how things are, and to make comparisons, it's got to remember how things were. So it also has to have a memory. So we'll see, as the talk develops, exactly which features of the chemotactic network are doing the sensing, doing the memory, and changing the rotation direction of the motors. But as I've promised, before we dive into the network and have to start looking at actual proteins, I want to think about this business of swimming up gradients from the point of view of engineering. Let's say that your assignment was to design a bacterium that could swim efficiently up gradients. What would you do? Well, I'll give you a few things. One is that you're going to need receptors, right? You're going to need something that can bind chemicals outside the cell and that can transduce that information inside the cell so the cell can respond, in this case, ultimately controlling the direction of the motors and deciding whether the cell is going to tumble or not. And so in this particular case, let's imagine we have a receptor whose activity is very high when there's no chemical attractants in the environment. And as the concentration of attractant in the environment is increased, the probability that this receptor will have an attractant bound goes up, and the activity goes down as a result. And the reason I've chosen this is because that's the way it works in E. coli. When there's more attractants, the activity of the receptors go down. So we might as well just get used to it now. This is a simple equilibrium process of binding and unbinding of these chemicals to the receptor. And when the receptor is in the bound state, that means it's inactive. It's in some conformation that does not activate things downstream inside the cell. So it said, well, okay, I could imagine building a sensory system out of that. The cell is sitting at some concentration. It swims to a region where the concentration is a little higher, and the activity comes down a little bit, and maybe that will influence whether the cell keeps swimming or not. You say, well, that looks okay, but what if the cell is swimming around at a higher concentration? Now the activity isn't changing very much. As the concentration goes up, you're not responding anymore. You say, well, all right, maybe my mistake was I chose the wrong dissociation constant for the binding of the chemical to the receptor. If I'd chosen a different value here, I could have gotten a different curve where the response was spread out over a larger range of chemical concentrations. And I'll tell you, even though you could choose this curve, well, you've got response over a wider range, you've given up some sensitivity here, but in fact, neither of these is going to work very well. And the problem is that these don't give you any gain. That is, at best, a 1% change in the chemical concentration turns into a 1% change in the receptor activity. And if that's all you've got, the cells swimming into a region where the chemical concentration is 1% higher would have, say, on average, only swim 1% farther. But it turns out that there are enough chemicals out there and enough receptors that if that cell senses that the chemical concentration is 1% higher, it can be absolutely sure it's swimming in the right direction. So it should be absolutely keep going. It should not just keep going 1% further on average. It should keep going definitely. So what it needs is it needs some gain to turn that 1% signal in here into a larger change in activity. And so the way that E. coli has solved this problem is to use cooperativity. So instead of individual receptors binding these chemicals by themselves and changing from active to inactive, the receptors work together in teams. And so I've shown you now the response if you have a team of, say, 10 receptors that are all working together. So now, when the attractant concentration in this region increases by 1%, the activity changes by 10%. And so what's really happening here is that we've taken these receptors and we've forced them to all be active together or all be inactive together. In which case, what you'll find is that, well, either the receptors, say, at low concentrations of the chemical, they'll all be active with no chemical bound. Over here, they'll all be inactive with chemical bound. And in the middle, the system will be switching back and forth between everybody active with no chemical or everybody inactive with chemical bound. For those who may have taken a biochemistry course at some stage, this is exactly how hemoglobin binds and unbinds oxygen. There are four actual subunits of hemoglobin, and they all like to be in the same of one of two states, a state that likes to bind oxygen or a state that doesn't. And as a result, if you look at the binding response of hemoglobin to oxygen, you get a curve that looks like a sigmoid. It goes the other direction, but the physics is the same, that hemoglobin is acting cooperatively by virtue of the subunits talking to each other and deciding that they'd all like to be in the same conformation. Well, in this case, the receptors are like the hemoglobin subunits. They're going to be either active or inactive, and the chemical that they're sensing is like the oxygen. So you're either going to be in one configuration where everybody is unoccupied by this chemical, or in the other where everybody is occupied. Now, in the case of hemoglobin, that's used so that you either pick up oxygen for sure in the lungs and you dump it all into the tissues. In chemotaxis, it's used for a different purpose. It's used because of the gain you get in this region here. Because this curve is very steep, as the probability of being in the two states is maximally sensitive to this chemical concentration. So that looks good, and if E. coli is now in this regime, it's actually now 10 times as sensitive to chemicals, and it can swim much more efficiently up these gradients. And in fact, there are other stages of the pathway that give you even more gain, so that the system can be essentially making binary decisions in response to small inputs. The problem, which you may have noticed, is that while this is great if you're swimming in this range of concentrations, you're actually doing lousy at lower concentrations or higher concentrations. So what is E. coli going to do about that? Well, it's had a billion years to think about different solutions, and so it's had a chance to come up with something pretty clever. And the idea is that the response curve that it uses is actually variable. So when E. coli is swimming around this concentration, it uses this response curve of its receptors. At lower concentrations, it uses this response curve. At higher concentrations, it uses this response curve. So it's always getting the maximum gain. And you say, wow, you know, that's great, but how does it know? You know, how much computing power does an E. coli have to know exactly which curve to use under which circumstances? And it turns out that there's actually no miracle here. There's a very simple feedback system that allows this adaptation system to work. And I should say, just for clarity, that when I said that E. coli has a memory, I'm exactly talking about its use of these different curves. The curve you're using represents sort of the state of the cell in terms of its memory. If it's been swimming around this concentration, it uses this curve, and as a result, swimming to higher concentrations, it remembers how it was in terms of which response curve it was using. If it ends up using a different curve, that's because it's now remembering a different concentration. So how does this work in practice? Well, let's say that E. coli was using this response curve, and it swam into a really good region, lots of good chemicals to eat. Well, initially, the activity goes down to zero. That means the cells keep swimming. That's what they're supposed to do when things are getting better. But ultimately, it's hanging out here for a while. It would like to see if maybe things could get even better in some new direction. How are we going to work that out? Well, the idea is that when these receptors are spending all of their time inactive, the receptors are actually getting chemically modified. They're getting charges neutralized on the receptors chemically. And every time that one of those charges gets neutralized, the response curve moves out to the right a little bit. And so as long as the receptor's activity is staying below some preferred level, which I've shown here, those receptors are constantly having more and more charges neutralized, and this curve is going to move out farther and farther until finally the curve has moved out far enough that the activity comes back to this preferred level, which I've shown here as being roughly 50%. So when the receptors are spending 50% of their time active and 50% of the time inactive, that's when there's no further chemical modification of the receptors. And it works the same the other way. If these cells swim into a bad region, these receptors get progressively have these chemical groups removed, so revealing the charges, and the response curve moves back out to here. And you see that by this scheme, by always adjusting so the activity comes back up to this preferred level, you're guaranteeing that you're always going to have a response which will have maximum gain. So the timescales for these are pretty short. E. coli is sensing its chemical environment about every quarter of a second. It's getting an update of how things are right now, right here. These curves are adjusting on the timescale of about every 2 seconds. So you use the curve for how things were 2 seconds ago, and you compare how things are now to decide whether things got better or got worse. But that separation between a quarter of a second and 2 seconds is enough that you're constantly updating. So if you swim around a region for around 2 seconds, you use the appropriate curve for that concentration, and now you can always be then sensitive to things getting better in one direction or worse in another. So you're always taking advantage of this gain that you get from cooperativity. So that is certainly true, and I'll show you data that proves that this is how it works. But there is a question which I've tried to highlight in the title of my talk, which is, you know, if cooperativity is so great, you get this gain, why isn't everybody doing it? And the answer that I'm going to propose today is that there's a cost to cooperativity. And the cost is that by putting these receptors together in teams, you've actually increased the noise in the system. And so the question we will be addressing in the second half of the talk is, what about the noise? And let me give you a little foreshadowing of that, why the noise might be an issue. Well, E. coli has got a bunch of receptors, but the receptors are either active or inactive. So they're either basically contributing a zero or one at any time. The output of a bunch of zeros and ones can be something that doesn't fluctuate, that has a particular mean. And particular, if these zeros and ones are individually flipping back and forth very quickly, then one can end up with an output of the whole system that has basically got very little noise. By using cooperativity, we've taken our zeros and ones and we've clustered them together in tens. So now we've got things that are either zero or 10. So we've got fewer individual degrees of freedom. But even more importantly, we've slowed down the rate at which they flip. So if there was a basic rate at which a receptor could flip from 0 to 1, active to inactive, this group of 10 receptors that are all talking to each other and holding each other in the same state will be exponentially slower than this rate. So not only is it 0 and 10, but it's 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 10. And as a result, our ability to beat down noise by time averaging is greatly reduced. And so this will be actually the theme of the talk. Which is better, to get the gain you get from cooperativity, or is it the penalty due to the increased noise make the performance of the system worse? And I won't answer that right now, but I want you to keep in mind that that's where we're going. All right, so I've tried to highlight the engineering challenge faced by E. coli. I hope you've gotten the picture of what these cells are trying to do. So let's look for just a moment at the network that the cells actually use to solve this problem. And so one of the nice things about this network is that everything in the engineering problem basically has one protein that does that thing. So it's very clear whose job is, you know, which protein is doing which job here. Another nice thing about it is that there are no new players. This system has been studied for so long in so many labs in so many ways that we're not going to be blindsided by another protein that, oh, we didn't know about. So you can actually trust that this really is the chemotaxis network. So here is my sketch of a cell. Here's the cytoplasmic membrane. Outside the cell, there are chemicals, maybe an amino acid or a sugar that the cell would like to eat. And these are rapidly binding and unbinding from these receptors. And I've called them MCPs because they are methyl-accepting chemotaxis proteins. The methyl is the group that neutralizes the charge on the receptors. And I've shown them clustered together because they are clustered together. And as we'll see, and as we learned, they are really cooperating. And they're cooperating because they're actually touching each other, just like the subunits of hemoglobin. The next important player down is this protein called key A. All the proteins here have letters, but their names are really key A or key Y for chemotaxis. This is the protein that responds to the activity state of the receptors. So when I say a receptor is active, what I mean is that it's tickling key A so that key A is doing its job, which is to take a chemical group away from an ATP molecule. And there's just ATP all over the cell. It's maintained by metabolism. It's the energy currency of the cell. So it's always there in the background. So key A will take a phosphate group from ATP. It'll attach it to itself. And then it will pass it on to the next protein, key Y. So active receptors means that phosphate is flowing onto key A, onto key Y. And then key Y is the diffusible protein. It'll diffuse around the cell. And what it does is it interacts with these motors, and it makes the motors go in the tumbly direction. So more of this phosphorylated key Y with a phosphate means the cell is changing direction. So you get more of that when things are getting worse, when things are bad. Now, what are these other guys doing? Well, key Z here is just there to strip the phosphates off key Y to update, to make sure that the turnover time is pretty fast. So this is the thing that says, we're only interested in the output of these receptors over the last quarter of a second, because we want a snapshot of how things are now. But by now, we mean over the last quarter of a second. So key Y does that. It strips these off, gets this pool of phosphorylated key Y turns over every quarter of a second because of key Z. The other players here, key W, well, that's just there to help bring these receptors together, to help them get together and cooperate. So it's a kind of clustering protein. And what we're missing still is the adaptation system, the things that lets the receptors change their response curves. This by itself does signal, but it would not let those curves move off to the right or move off to the left. That's implemented by this protein, key R. And key R says when it finds that the receptors are inactive, it neutralizes a charge by adding a methyl group. So key R is just saying, oh, you guys are inactive, I'm just going to add methyl groups. And that's balanced by this protein key B, where when it sees a receptor that's active, it's going to remove one of those methyl groups. So you have these two opposing activities. And the idea is the way the system adapts, the way it has a preferred level of activity, is that key R is adding methyl groups at a certain rate that depends on the fraction of the time the receptors are active. So when receptors are inactive, key R is working. When they're active, key R isn't working. So it's adding methyl groups at a rate that depends on activity. Similarly, key B is removing methyl groups at a rate that depends on activity. So you have these two things, adding methyl groups, removing methyl groups. Those rates depend on activity. Steady state can only occur if these two rates are equal. If there's more adding methyl groups than removing them, you'll keep accumulating methyl groups, and vice versa. So the idea is that this system is designed such that, well, look, no matter what you do to the system, you perturb it, get these rates out of balance, there's going to be some net accumulation of methyl groups on the receptors. The receptors are going to change their activity until finally these two rates are in balance. Since the rates only depend on receptor activity, there's only some particular magic value of the activity that will bring these two rates together, and the system will always adapt back to that activity. It will always have to come back to the point where there's the rate of adding methyl groups is the same as removing them. And that's exactly what gave you that preferred level of activity in the original plot, the thing that said, why are receptors active 50% of the time? Well, when the receptors are active 50% of the time, that's exactly the magic point of cancellation when adding methyl groups is occurring at the same rate of removing them. And so that's how the system implements its adaptation, and it's an example of integral feedback for those who are have some background in engineering. There's one last little loop here that says that this enzyme gets a phosphate from key A that's actually not necessary for this system to work. It adds a little bit of a homeostatic mechanism, a little bit of a mechanism that maintains balance here, because one thing to remember about this is that all of these components are being made by the cell divides, there are randomness here, so these levels can fluctuate a little, and this thing basically damps down the effect of the fluctuations, keeping that set point near 50% activity where you're in the region where you get the maximum gain. So I want to talk now a little bit more about the receptors, because they're going to be the stars of this particular story. So the idea is that these receptors are clustered and working together, and one can see this at various scales. So at the largest scale, if you look at a particular cell, you'll see that the receptors are forming, say, two big clusters, one at each end of the cell. And this could have 5,000 receptors in each cluster. The reason we can see them is that these proteins have been made as genetic constructs, where the receptor is part of one big protein that has a separate domain, separate from the receptor itself, that's naturally fluorescent. So when you shine UV light on these, you get to see where all the receptors are. And you can see that that's true in E. coli. It's also true in other bacteria that are rather distant relatives of E. coli. It's even true in this other single-celled organism, which is from the kingdom Archaea. These guys are about as distantly related as any two organisms on Earth. But again, the receptors in each are forming these big clusters at the end. This is probably not that surprising because it turns out there's really one fundamental chemotaxis system in all of these single-celled organisms. There seems to have been a common ancestor that got it right, and this was then passed down. So it turns out that by studying E. coli in a lot of detail and figuring out how it works doesn't mean we've solved only 1/1,000,000th of the problem for the million species out there. We've really basically got a handle on how this works throughout, you know, all of the kingdoms of these single-celled organisms. So it's worth working hard on this one organism. Now, if you look at a more microscopic scale, this is what the proteins look like. A given receptor will actually have two proteins that come together to form a dimer. Here's the region that sits outside the cell that's binding and unbinding, say, an amino acid. There's a region that goes through the cell membrane, and then there's these long alpha helices, this part protein structure, that go into the cell. And this is where key W will sit that will bundle the receptors together. This is where key A will sit, whose job it is to strip phosphate off ATP, pass it on to key Y. And finally, I want to highlight that these charges that get neutralized by methyl groups or get charged up again when the methyl groups are related are specific residues, specific sites on these proteins that either accept these methyl groups or have these methyl groups removed. Now, the proteins are organized not just in these big clusters and in these dimers. They're organized at other scales as well. So these dimers themselves form trimers. This is from an X-ray structure of this region of the proteins. But it's also seen in living cells by cross-linking experiments that here will be one dimer, there's another. And interestingly, this could be a dimer that is sensitive to a sugar. This could be a dimer that's sensitive to an amino acid. So the different chemical signals that the cell is responding to are coming in and are being integrated right by these groups of interacting receptors. Turns out that in E. coli, there are five receptors. It's easy to remember. E. coli has five senses, just like we do. However, it's become clear in recent years that this is not all there is to it, that these trimers of dimers, as they're called, are themselves organized into a very regular honeycomb lattice. Here's one trimer, there's another trimer, and so on. This is an image taken by electron microscopy from a living cell, and you see that there's a perfect lattice. It looks much more like a crystal or something that is forming inside these cells. So there's an interesting question of how the cells manage to organize these proteins or self-organize these proteins into these large arrays. So the key for our talk, though, is that the receptors are close to each other, and in fact, they're not just close to each other, they're working together. So how do we know they're working together? Well, this is based on these fluorescence resonance energy transfer studies that I mentioned. And the idea here is you'd like to see this level of phosphorylated KY. That's what gets produced by the receptors. That's what gets sensed by the motors. I've mentioned to you that the biologists are good at attaching fluorescent proteins to other proteins, but that won't tell us whether this particular protein does or does not have a little phosphate group attached to it. How are we going to figure that out? Well, the beauty is that in this system, this protein KZ, who's responsible for the fast turnover time, only interacts with KY when there's a phosphate attached. So the idea is to construct KY with one fluorescent protein, say yellow fluorescent protein attached to it, KZ with another fluorescent protein, say cyan fluorescent protein attached to it. Now, if KY doesn't have a phosphate attached, KZ doesn't care about it, they're drifting apart, I excite with UV light this cyan fluorescent protein, I get cyan light out. I can see these things glowing blue. On the other hand, if this KY does have a phosphate group attached, it binds very strongly to the KZ. That brings the cyan fluorescent protein close to the yellow fluorescent protein. And now the excitation energy can get transferred with high efficiency to the yellow fluorescent protein. And now the light comes out yellow. So by looking at what's coming out in blue and what's coming out in yellow and taking the ratio, one can effectively count how many of these KYs inside the cell have a phosphate attached. And that's telling us exactly how active are these receptors. It's telling us what the cell would be doing in terms of whether it would be swimming straight or tumbling. And so here's the data from this kind of experiment, looking at the ratio of what comes out. Here's the ratio. Then you add some attractant, some amino acid, and boom, the ratio drops down because you've actually driven everything in this direction. And now you see that the ratio is going back. That's not because of bleaching or any experimental artifact. That's because these cells adapt. If they're spending most of the receptor spending their time inactive, then the adaptation system is adding methyl groups, which is making the receptors more and more active again. And you see that the output is coming right back up to where it started. But now the cells have gotten used to this, they're being more attractant around. That's their memory. Their recent memory is that there's a lot of attractant. So if we go back to the way things were, the cells are very unhappy about that. Things have gotten worse. And so you see now that just removing this attractant gives you this spike in the other direction, moving you down here, and that would induce a tumble. So those cells, they get used to the way things were every few seconds, and they're always comparing how things are now to how things were then. And if you had any doubt that it was these proteins, KR and KB, that are doing the adaptation, you can just look at cells in which these proteins have been knocked out. They still respond to an addition of attractant, but they don't adapt anymore. OK, so what can one do with that? Well, what one can do is one can now do this experiment over and over again very quickly, say with different levels of attractant, different types of attractant, and with cells where the receptors are in different states. So for example, this data comes from cells that only express one type of receptor. So we've gotten rid of four of E. coli's senses. It's only got one left, and it's responding to aspartate or some variants of aspartate like methyl aspartate. And we can prepare these receptors in more or less charged states, and they will just stay in that state. So if we have cells that are basically all neutralized, they're responding out there. They're very, very strongly active until you get to a very high level of attractant. And as we reveal these charges more and more, the response moves back to the left like this. And this is supposed to look like those schematics I showed you at the beginning of these response curves that are both cooperative, very steep coming down, and the cell gets to choose which one it wants to use by how many of these charges are neutralized. One thing that I won't dwell on too much, but was revealed by this kind of quantitative study, is not just that the system adapts, always, you know, in wild type using the appropriate curve so that you get the maximum gain, but in fact the steepness of these curves also adapts. So the size, and effectively the sizes of these teams, the numbers of receptors that are working together, goes from, say, six receptors corresponding to two trimers working together at this end, which would be occurring if the cells were swimming around in an environment that was very nutrient poor, to maybe 15 receptors or five of these trimers all working together in the regime where the cells are swimming around at high concentrations of nutrients. It's as if hemoglobin had a choice of being four subunits under some circumstances, or maybe eight subunits under others, or 12 under others, and getting a steeper and steeper response curve to oxygen. Here, the response curve is to this other small chemical, methyl aspartate. I won't dwell on it, but we can understand all of these curves in terms of a very simple free energy model, where, in fact, the two states, receptors being all active or all inactive, simply have two different free energies, and the probability of being in one state or the other is just determined by that relative free energy according to Boltzmann weights. So underlying the complexity of having multiple receptors and being able to change their energies by either methylating them or having ligand bound is a very simple physical idea that these receptors are just two-state systems with a thermal balance or thermal occupancy of those two different states. Now, I don't want to spend all my time on that, and I have only 10 minutes to go. I want to now focus on this question of, if cooperativity and gain are so good, why aren't those found universally? Well, the first question is, are they? And so there are a number of systems that have been studied almost as well as E. coli chemotaxis. One is this amoeba dictyostelium that crawls around as single cells, but when conditions get bad, the cells signal to each other, they get together, and they form this aggregate that's a multicellular type organism. It can crawl away and eventually form a beautiful fruiting body. And they do this in response to this chemical called cyclic AMP. So they really, really care about this chemical. It's all, their whole developmental cycle depends on sensing this. And yet the receptors for cyclic AMP, these CAR1 receptors, are uniformly spread out over the cell. And there's no sign of either clustering or cooperativity there. Now, this is admittedly a very distant relative of E. coli. You could argue maybe it never got around to evolving cooperativity. But here's another bacterium that's actually not that distant a relative of E. coli. It's doing something called quorum sensing. These cells, as they grow up in density, they're making small chemicals. They're sensing those same chemicals as a way of assaying population density. And when they have enough cells together, they'll turn on collective activities like making virulence factors to attack a host or making light so that the cell colonies can be seen, things that wouldn't work well if done by individual cells. And in this particular case, the receptors that are being used to sense those chemicals are evolutionary relatives of the chemotaxis receptors. They're not very different. And yet in this case, where we've measured the response curves, there is no cooperativity. These guys are working as individual receptors. So even though they're very similar and have a similar history, they've decided not to use cooperativity. So why not? Well, As I've hinted at, the issue is that cooperativity not only could, but does increase the noise. And so how are we going to understand that in a concrete way? Well, what we've basically got is a two-state system. Receptors can be inactive or they can be active. They cooperate because the receptors in an active state want its neighbors to also be in an active state, or a receptor in an inactive state wants its neighbors to be in an inactive state. So we've got some energy that couples the receptors, trying to keep them in the same state. This is exactly something that, you know, physicists have been studying for generations, called the Ising model. Two-state systems with some kind of nearest neighbor coupling. So we can adapt that simple Ising model, originally developed for describe magnets, to describe these interacting receptors. And we can study this then by writing down, well, here's the free energy of coupled receptors. These we'll think of, these variables are ones and minus ones for active and inactive, but if you like spins, there are spin up and spin down. And there's a free energy introduced by how much chemical there is in the environment that prefers to bind, say, to inactive receptors rather than to active ones. This looks, in the language of spins, like a magnetic field that we've applied. And so we'd like to know, how does this system respond to the application of small magnetic fields? And we'd also like to know, how much noise is there due to the fact that these receptors are either active together or inactive? So if I look at the output of this system, I've got, as I've said, these things that are sort of zeros and ones that are being output and that are flipping at a certain rate. If I only get to average over a certain amount of time, how much is that signal going to fluctuate just due to the intrinsic switching noise of these receptors? Well, in order to understand that, we have to have some model for the kinetics, and we're just going to adopt Glauber's heat bath dynamics, which is consistent with the thermodynamics. That's necessary. And it also has the feature that there's a maximum rate of which a receptor can flip. Even if it wants to, if it's going downhill in energy, it can't flip faster than some basic rate alpha, which is reasonable. This protein has some conformational time it's going to take to change its conformation. So we use heat bath dynamics. So now, doing that, we can take this, say, this little string of 10 receptors that are coupled together and to be in the same state, and we can ask, well, do you get gain out of this system? And this, the gain is basically this active axis here. It's the response of the system. And this axis here is telling you how strongly you've coupled the receptors together. So for reference, if the receptors are uncoupled, each one is acting as a free agent. You get a response of 10, because there are 10 receptors. But as you couple them stronger and stronger, and you're willing to wait around for them to equilibrate, you get a tenfold increase in this response. And that was this factor of 10 gain that you had. Now the receptors work together in teams. They're really going to prefer to be all active or all inactive together. So you're really seeing the magnetic field multiplied by 10, because it's acting on all receptors together. Now, if you have a shorter averaging time, then you may not let the system get to equilibrium. So in a finite amount of time, you may not see this full response. But there's still some gain is available in the system, even for shorter averaging times. What about the noise? Well, the noise is such that if you go to very strong coupling, you find that these receptors are basically locked together forever. They become so hysteretic that they just stay in one state, everybody active or everybody inactive. And this is the maximum noise you can get, that you either get the output as, you know, everybody up is 10 or everybody down is 0. That corresponds to this level. Now, for finite amounts of coupling, though, you see that the averaging time is hugely important. For short averaging time, I get a certain amount of noise. But if I'm willing to average longer, I really beat down the noise. And this is exactly the way you usually get rid of noise in a system. You say, I've got a noisy system, but I want to figure out what its average behavior is. No, just average the output over a long time. The fluctuations will go away, and you'll see the true average. And that's exactly what's happening here as one goes to longer and longer averaging times. But you can see that, like, by increasing J, the noise, even for long averaging time, is going up. And that's because even if I set a long averaging time, if I couple the receptors too tightly together, the time it takes them to all switch from everybody up to everybody down gets longer and longer, because this is a very energetically unfavorable event. If everybody's active and I want to go to inactive, at least one of those receptors has to go to that unfavorable state. It's going to cost me this interaction energy, and it's going to have to therefore be a very rare process. Energetically expensive processes are rare. They happen very seldom. So the question is, what happens when we put together these two effects? Increasing J gives me more and more gain, larger response. Increasing J also gives me more noise. What's going to happen to the signal-to-noise ratio? Is there going to be some optimum at some particular value of J? And the answer is, there sure is an optimum. It's at J equals zero. So after all that business of gain being good, it turns out that if you want to optimize the signal-to-noise ratio, give up the gain. You do much better by having these receptors work as individuals and just switch back and forth, do lots and lots of sampling of the environment very quickly, and then over a given averaging time, you just win so much by beating down the noise that you're better off than if you had tried to take advantage of gain. So it raises, of course, an interesting question, because E. coli has had a billion years to figure this out, and it's decided that gain is good, right? These other cells have also had a billion years, so they've decided gain is bad. So who's right here? Well, the first question could be, well, you guys studied 10 receptors in a line. What if you put the receptors in a ring or in two dimensions, or you had 100 receptors? Would your story change? Well, the beauty of basing any analysis on the Ising model is that everything about the Ising model is known. So in particular, there are scaling relations that tell you, well, what exactly is the response? It turns out to be the susceptibility. What is the time? It's the correlation time. We know exactly how the response and the correlation time of the Ising model behave in one dimension, in two dimensions, and so on. And the answer is that one dimension is a bad choice, and in fact, but larger systems are actually worse. Going up here means that it's even more favorable to be uncoupled if you're a large system. And things aren't quite as bad in two dimensions, but they're still getting worse with larger systems, and they're still always worse than uncoupled receptors. And in fact, things don't actually become as good as uncoupled receptors until you're in the limit where all the receptors are talking to each other, and even that's no better than uncoupled receptors. So from the point of view of signal-to-noise ratio, give it up. You're just better with uncoupled receptors. So what's wrong? E. coli is not stupid. So we thought about a few things. Well, you know, we treated this ligand binding as being fast compared to receptor switching. What if it's slow? Maybe that new time scale will slow down individual receptors enough, and that slowing will make them not much better than coupled receptors, and that'll be a win for the coupled receptors. Turns out, that's right. If the ligand binding and unbinding is very slow, you can't sample the environment faster than you can bind and unbind a chemical. So that slows down the response dynamics of the individual receptors. But it turns out that this slow binding and unbinding also slows down the coupled receptors just as much, so that the ratio doesn't change, everything gets slower. That's no good. Oops. That's no good. What about extrinsic noise? Each of these receptors might have a different number of charges on it by this methylation demethylation. Is that going to save us? There's another source of noise. Maybe if that's the main source of noise, it's going to favor the coupled receptors. No good. I won't go through the details, but you should remember that these coupled receptors are really, really good at amplifying external signals, including this noisy signal from the individual receptors having different numbers of charges. So exactly this extra noise is bigger for the coupled receptors. Again, it doesn't do any better. So having ruled out these possibilities, we came back to the possibility that maybe we're asking the wrong question. Signal-to-noise ratio is a very nice, simple way of characterizing behavior of systems. Engineers love to use it. There are various theorems that show if you want to maximize information transfer about through some system, you should maximize the signal-to-noise ratio. But no one actually promised us that this is what E. coli needed to know about its environment. Doesn't need to know everything about its environment. It just needs to know that part of the information that lets it swim up a gradient. So it turns out that this is the answer. And I only have a minute left, and it's only going to take about that, because I don't want to give a whole separate talk on this. But the idea is we shouldn't be asking how to optimize signal-to-noise ratio. We should be asking how to optimize this chemotactic velocity. As that's what E. coli really cares about. And so the idea is pretty simple. You want a cell to swim up a gradient. We'll consider a shallow gradient, because that's the thing that's hard. Any fool bacteria can swim up a steep gradient. All this investment in gain and so on is to swim up shallow gradients to get to the food first. So you say, well, how far should an E. coli swim on average? What would be its best choice? If it swims too short, it doesn't get to sense much of the difference between up gradient and down gradient, doesn't have much time to tell this difference. So that can't be good. You can't swim too short, or you don't really get a good measurement. So you should swim longer. Well, why not swim really long? And then we can get a big difference between the concentration. We've had a lot of time to average. Well, that would be good if E. coli could swim straight very long. But E. coli is like my kid. You throw him in the swimming pool. He swims, but he swims this way, and then he swims that way. So there's rotational diffusion on these cells. They can only swim straight for a few seconds. So there's no point going for a lot longer than that, because you might have done a 180. Things have gotten better, but actually you shouldn't keep swimming because you're pointing in the wrong direction. So there's some optimum. And this has to do with the rate of rotational diffusion. Okay, based on how fast that is, you should choose this distance to swim. So now, what about this business of getting coupling the receptors to get gain? What do we get from that? Well, if we have certain receptors, say they're uncoupled, on average, if we swim in the right direction, we'd get a little bonus on average, because things have gotten better. We'd swim a little farther. And similarly, if we swim in the wrong direction, things are getting a little worse. What gain is going to do, like say you have a gain by a factor of 2, that's as if the gradient was twice as big. It's a big win. We would double the size of this little arrow, the average distance you would swim from the gain. So what is noise going to do? Well, noise is going to say, well, there's fluctuations of this KYP due to the noisy output that have nothing to do with this gradient. That's just the intrinsic noise. That could make us swim shorter, or it could make us swim longer. And so in any particular run, the noise could be bigger than the signal. That sounds bad. We wouldn't really have swum farther this way than that way. But you got to remember that E. coli doesn't get one chance to swim up a gradient. It's not that it swims and that's it. It does this over and over and over and over again. It swims this way, and then it turns and it swims that way, and it swims this way. It's like a huge ensemble average, right? And when you take a huge ensemble average, what emerges is the systematic part, the thing that's there on average every time. When you take that huge ensemble average, the noise gets averaged away. So the thing about E. coli doing chemotaxis is that it's not a one-shot. It's doing thousands and thousands of runs as it's going in this gradient, and that's averaging away all the noise, keeping only the signal. And indeed, as long as there's always a signal there, a little delta going in the right direction, when you've added up enough of these runs up the gradient and down the gradient, all that will emerge is that net drift velocity. So you get a huge win by gain, because that means that the part that's left gets doubled or tripled or something by the gain, whereas the noise that could have been very bad in any individual run gets averaged away by this huge effective ensemble averaging. So the key is that noise reduces the drift velocity only gradually and goes away with averaging, where signal increases this drift velocity linearly. So before I close, I want to point out that this system, while it's one of the best studied biological systems in the world, still has many open questions. I've highlighted the one of, like, when is cooperativity advantageous and why in some cells and not in others. I've proposed a solution that chemotaxis is special because it's making this measurement over and over again. Cells doing quorum sensing, they do it once. If the chemical concentration builds up, they get one call. Have we passed the threshold and we should do the multicellular thing or not? That said, even within E. coli, we don't know what controls this cooperativity and its adaptation and why, in fact, cooperativity adapts, why we have bigger and bigger teams working together, and we don't even know why the cell needs 5,000 chemoreceptors. It's, again, probably about signal to noise, But it's a big investment for these cells every time they divide to make an additional 5,000 receptors. It must be a very important number. So to conclude, I introduced some of you, I believe, to the E. coli chemotaxis network. I've shown you a few of its remarkable features, including the fact that the receptors cooperate. That's there to increase the gain. And not only is there gain, but the gain and the cooperativity associated with it actually adapt to the condition the cells are in. But interestingly, and to us, at least initially, very surprisingly, cooperativity, while it's good for signal, is bad for signal-to-noise ratio. And so where you see cooperativity, you've got to understand that it's not simply the signal-to-noise ratio that's determining the behavior. So what it does turn out, though, is that if you actually look at what E. coli cares about, which is chemotactic velocity, that really is increased by increasing the signal up to a threshold where even the signal goes away. If you have too much noise, you tumble immediately. You never actually get the benefit of making a measurement of whether you're going up or down gradient. And the other question then is when we see these other cells, like these amoeba or these cells that are doing quorum sensing, are they in fact not clustering their receptors because they're doing something biologically which comes out to be much closer to optimizing the signal-to-noise ratio? So that's it, and I wanted to thank you very much for your attention.